in your ears. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Michigan's Secretary of State is keeping an eye on new voting machines today.
The machines are working well and things are pretty smooth, so we're really glad to hear that.
We'll talk to a reporter who found more problems with Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency computer.
Really, from the moment it came online, big problems started to show up.
In addition to wrongly accusing unemployed people of fraud, we'll talk about the plan to block Asian carp from the Great Lakes and why.
They'll also be in our rivers. They will also be in our inland lakes. And so that is why we are so afraid of these fish getting in.
And Shakespeare, like you've not seen.
There's blood and togas in the first act, and in the second act, there's fatigues and AK-47s and a lot of cool gunplay on stage.
But before we do that, let's find out what's happening in this hour's news. Welcome to Stateside. Hi there, I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. It's primary election day for cities across Michigan. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Secretary of State Ruth Johnson about new voting machines being tried out in Michigan.
For the people that work there, they're much more compact, easier to transport, easier to set up.
But first, you've probably heard about the state of Michigan's unemployment insurance computer system wrongly alleging fraud against thousands of people who filed for unemployment benefits. It's a mess that's still being worked out, and in many cases, the state is resisting making the people it wronged whole. Well, a new report from the Gongwer News Service indicates that there were concerns about that new computer system from the early days of it being implemented. Zach Gorchow wrote that report. Using the Freedom of Information Act, you found out that emails within the department indicated problems extended beyond the jobless benefit claims. It also failed when it came to the state's cases against companies who were charged with not paying the employer's state unemployment tax. Tell us about that.
That's right. So we thought it would be interesting to see what some of the very top people with responsibilities over the Unemployment Insurance Agency were saying around the period when the new computer system, which is called the Michigan Integrated Data Automated System, or MIDAS, came online. And that system came online October 1st, 2013. So we asked for emails sent and received by Steve Arwood, who at the time was the director of the department with oversight over the agency and had just departed after more than 2 years as the director of the Unemployment Insurance Agency itself, and Stephanie Komai, who was the deputy director of the department with direct oversight of the Unemployment Insurance Agency. We wanted to see what they had been sending and receiving in their emails about the switchover of the system. And what those emails showed was that really from the moment it came online, big problems started to show up. One of the biggest right away was that the information, the cases from the previous computer system, the data was missing. So the state had a number of cases where it was had told employers, you know, they had violated state unemployment tax laws as far as how they were paying those taxes. And the employers had protested, and so the case was going to go before an administrative law judge, and the case files were missing. So the state was in a very bad position. Obviously, you're not going to really be able to prove much of a case if you don't have the supporting materials. That was one thing that showed up, and this really surprised and unnerved people.
That would tick off your agency lawyers, you would think, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the people who were directly in charge of these cases were yelling and screaming, basically saying, you know, somebody's got to do something about this. And we told people at the time when the new system was coming online that it had to translate to bring back the old data. Basically, the old system had records going back to 1999, and the new system could only go back to the middle of 2010. Well, these cases often involve years and years of issues. So, you know, going back 3 years, which is what they had access to at the time, was nowhere near sufficient.
So is there any way to know how many cases had to be given up for a lack of data because of this computer system not transferring that data to the new system?
No. It's unclear from the records we received how sweeping the issue was. However, one of the emails, which came from the person who was in charge of the state unemployment tax program within the agency, described it as very sweeping. He said this is affecting lots of cases. He mentioned, as I recall at the time, just nine that were in the Wayne Circuit Court alone. It sounds like it's probably quite a bit more than that, but I can't put a number on it.
So it sounds like two things are happening here. Number one, they're not able to, you know, slap these guys with a fine and they can continue their practices the way they've been doing it, which the state felt was wrong. And number two, The state just lost out on a lot of fine money. Some of these ran into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
There was one, I believe, that was in the high hundreds of thousands of dollars. The number $700,000 sounds familiar without having it right in front of me. You know, they were trying to settle some of these cases. And that was one of the things we found, is they realized we need to come to a settlement here. And employers were turning that down because they knew that something was clearly amiss. So, you know, another thing we found is that the sheer amount of problems that people were flagging with the system just began to explode. It increased about sevenfold over a matter of a couple months, the number of issues people were identifying and flagging as the system came online. And this was clearly alarming to superiors, big, big concern, irrespective of the new computer system, in the sense that it wasn't so much the computer system's fault as it was, that appeared to be more of a staff issue. The backlog in dealing with these employer tax cases was just absolutely massive. Now, the employer portion of the computer system came online in 2012. The portion that came online October 1 was for people filing for jobless benefits. And so they had had about a year's worth of experience with the system, and this backlog, they were saying at the time, remember this is in the summer of 2013, that it was going to take until May 2016 to resolve this backlog. And again, these high-level folks in these departments were just aghast that this is what it was going to take. They cast it at the time as largely a staff issue. You know, I can't pinpoint exactly what the problem was, but it is worth noting that the agency did slash its staff roughly around the time the system came online. Whether that was a factor, I don't know. The email certainly described it more as a staff doing its job well issue. It's just hard to say exactly what led to that, but it was clear at the time they felt like the computer system was supposed to introduce new efficiency, but there was a sense that folks hadn't been properly trained on how to use it, and they weren't getting really the bang for the buck that they thought.
Well, if you spend millions of dollars on a new system, of course it's not the new system's fault, right?
Right.
You report the new computer system even caused problems in complying with a mandatory report to the legislature. How so?
Well, I don't have a ton of detail on that, but the guy who managed the state unemployment tax program, they are required under, I believe, it's either under statute or under their budget, to produce a report for the legislature chronicling, you know, basic data points, how many cases are in the system, how fast things are moving through, and that kind of stuff. And from what I could gather from the email he sent is because the computer system was not allowing him to access older data, he was struggling to be able to produce this report. Now, whether he was eventually able to produce it, I can't say for sure because this was a four-month window of emails I was looking at. I suspect that they must have at some point been able to produce something. You know, whether it was to the legislature's liking, I don't know, but that's what that was about.
So you point out, as you've said today, that the email exchanges become increasingly full of frustration and exasperation among the upper managers. While all of this is going on, what were these agency officials telling the governor?
Well, basically, the governor was interested in what kind of efficiencies this new system would bring based on what these top agency and department people said. I mean, I don't have any emails from the governor himself or anything like that. But there was clearly a desire to show the governor, look at all the efficiency that's been gotten. Steve Arwood, who was the director of the department I've been mentioning, said that the governor was very interested in this. There was a great deal of focus on putting together a one-page summary of all the efficiencies that would occur that the governor could use as part of his sort of reinventing performance in Michigan, showing that government is becoming more efficient. There was an employee, a high-level employee, who was tasked with keeping the governor up to date on numbers. So it was clear that efficiency was clearly a major goal with this, which I guess, you know, would make sense. But at least not that I could tell. There was less focus, you know, whoa, we need to tell high-level people about all these, you know, we're missing case files and that kind of stuff. I never saw anything like that. And the only time I saw, you know, a sense like, well, you know, we need to tell the governor there was a problem is the very first day the system opened, there were major problems with the phone line for people to call for jobless benefits. It was overwhelmed, fast, busy signal was occurring, and there was an email sent to the governor and his top staff basically saying, well, here's what happened, and here's what we're doing about it, and that sort of thing. So that was the one place where I did see there was a concern about how services were being affected for people.
So You note their email exchanges becoming increasingly full of frustration and exasperation among these top managers. While all of this was going on, what were officials telling the governor's office?
There was clearly a sense to show this is working and this is going very well. Steve Arwood, the director of the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, which oversaw at the time the Unemployment Insurance Agency, sent an email to a person in the governor's office at the time who was very involved in data and showing that systems were working well, saying that this is going great. He said this was going to win, quote unquote, national awards. They had gotten the system up online in 2 years instead of what he said was the usual five. They had done it under budget, and the efficiencies were going to be tremendous. And, you know, at that point, there was no statement about, you know, boy, you know, we're seeing some signs of problems here. It seemed to be a bit of a disconnect.
By the way, is that Midas computer system still being used? And if so, is it working correctly now?
It is still being used, but not in the way that it was for jobless benefits for an almost two-year period. So from October 1, 2013, to August 7, 2015, it was the sole determinant of whether someone committed fraud to get unemployment benefits. There was basically no human involvement. That was the case for about 23,000 cases. Then there's another 30,000 cases during that time period where there was some human involvement, but the computer was heavily involved. They're still trying to determine how many of those were wrong. People were wrongly rung up as having committed fraud.
Yeah, the figure I've seen is that maybe as much as 93% of those accused of some kind of fraud were wrongly accused.
That's right. That's of those 23,000 cases where only the computer was involved. It was wrong 93% of the time. So it is still being used, but it is no longer the sole factor. There has to be staff human involvement to make a determination that someone committed fraud.
That is Zach Gorchow with the Gongware News Service. Hey, nice reporting, Zach. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Shakespeare, like you've not seen. Plus, we'll hear how the massive VA health system was born. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taken and no giving. They just use your mind, and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it.
Well, it's time to hear theater talk, and joining me now is David Kiley with Encore Michigan to talk about some new performances around the state. We just heard the theme from 9 to 5. I guess that's a good place to start, right? It's one of the musical openings, I understand.
That's right. It's one of two, actually one of three musical openings we have. This is at the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter. We'll be seeing 9 to 5, which opened this past Friday. And this is based, of course, on the film of the same name that starred Jane Fonda, Dolly Parton, and Lily Tomlin. It's a very popular musical about the women in an office who are dealing with a really lecherous boss. And they are unsuccessful in poisoning him. But he finds out that they tried, and before he can turn anyone in, he gets tied up and held captive until the ladies can figure out what to do with him.
Mayhem
ensues.
Yes. So what's the second one? Or you said three, right?
Yes.
So,
at the Barn Theater in Augusta, which is a summer theater, we have Newsies opening this week. It's a wonderful show about the newsboy strike in 1899, New York City. And it actually opens this evening. It's got great tunes, like one I'm particularly fond of called Seize the Day, and another one is called Brooklyn's Here. And young folks especially like this show, so it's really great for the whole family.
Let's talk about the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. It was in Jackson, and it's moved now.
That's right. They are having a wonderful season, the Shakespeare Festival. They're doing Julius Caesar, Taming of the Shrew, and they're doing Chekhov's Seagull.
And this is all happening at the Village Theater in Canton, right?
Correct, yeah. Starting last year, they sort of broke up the season, so they've been at Jackson, at Jackson Community College, and now they have moved to another great venue, the Village Theater in Canton. I can't recommend these shows enough. Julius Caesar, for example, was one of the best productions I've ever seen. And I think teenagers, this is, as the father of a teenager, I want to say this, that he saw it this past weekend, and he loved it. They've done these plays in such a way that's so accessible for everybody, including, I want to say, some of your recalcitrant teens who are a little reluctant to see Shakespeare, I think will love these shows.
I understand in Julius Caesar, it's kind of like the Romeo and Juliet film that we saw a few years ago. The swords turned into a 45 caliber pistol, and you've got AK-47s?
Yes, in Act Two of Julius Caesar, there's blood and togas in the first act, and in the second act, there's fatigues and AK-47s and a lot of cool gunplay on stage.
Of course, because AK-47s were so common in
it's a modern update and a very effective one. I'm sometimes a little hard on modern updates of Shakespeare, but this one was terrific.
All right, let's go to Grand Rapids, Pigeon Creek Theater Company.
This is an excellent company, and they're doing a seldom-performed Shakespeare play called Cymbeline, also known sometimes as Cymbeline, King of Britain. It's a play often listed as a tragedy, but it's really more of a romance, and it has some light moments. The play's about early Celtic British rule. And this is one of those plays that has a really passionate following among performers and some audience members and some scholars. Some reviewers over the years have kind of said it's a little bit of a meh play of Shakespeare's, but I don't think so at all. And they're doing something wonderful with it, and it will play at the Dog Story Theater in Grand Rapids to start, and then it moves around. Come to Encore, Michigan, and you'll be able to see where the performances are near you.
Your website, and that is?
EncoreMichigan.com.
So I'd say Shakespeare on a meh day is probably better than most of what we see out there. Right. Let's move on now to the Waterford Township Monster Box Theater. What are they doing?
Well, they're doing a really interesting play called Now Hear This. And it's kind of a sequel to a play called Title of Show. And it's written by the same authors and same characters. This is a musical also. Follows the evolution and adventures of four friends in a natural history museum. And they journey through time from present day museum to the past and back again. It's a play that tackles really serious issues, but with quirky humor, energy, kind of a meaning of life show. Terrific musical score. And it really ranges from touching to funny. And it's a minimal set, which is kind of cool. It's really just the actors and a video screen because they play around with some projection. And in one song, there's four rolling chairs, and that's it for the set. But I think people will really like this. It's funny. It's musical. And Monster Box up in Waterford is doing some really nice work.
Let's go to Coldwater. I didn't even know about the Tibbetts Theater in Coldwater.
Well, it's a historic opera house, a wonderful venue, and they have a show called The Fox on the Fairway. And it's a comedy that takes place at a private country club. You don't have to have a 5 handicap to appreciate it, believe me. I don't play golf very often, but this is a very nice show. And very accessible to everyone. Kind of light comedy for the summer, which is what you want to do in August, especially if you've seen a couple of Shakespeare tragedies. You want to go to Coldwater and see a nice light comedy.
Finally, you've got an awards ceremony coming up.
Yes, the Wild Awards. Some people might call them the Michigan Tonys. And Encore Michigan does this show every year where we reward and award the best performances and the best artists of the previous season. It's August 28th at the Berman Center for Performing Arts in West Bloomfield, and it's open to the public. And we have some of the best talents in Michigan will be performing. You can find all the details at EncoreMichigan.com. August 28th, there's a link to buy tickets. It's a very reasonably priced ticket for all the entertainment we're packing in that night. And as I say, the public is welcome.
That is David Kiley with Encore Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much, Lester.
Nearly 9 million of America's veterans get medical care from the Veterans Administration. It's America's largest integrated health system. And it all began 96 years ago this day with the stroke of a pen and the signature of President Warren G. Harding. We hear the story from University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell. He spoke with stateside Cynthia Canty.
Now, we're talking about 1921, so that's fewer than 3 years after the end of World War I. How were things for America's vets then?
Not very good. Now, they were promised as early as 1917 that they would have some form of care as a result of their serving in the armed forces. But that never came to be, and it was always disjointed through the United States Public Health Service and through various pension funds and even a veterans home for the disabled. But it was not the organized, integrated system that Americans are used to today.
So it was an unsatisfying patchwork quilt cobbled together.
If you will. Yeah, not even a quilt because it didn't keep you very warm. And, you know, the federal government, of course, was very different and far smaller back then. And also you had all these men coming back, some 4 million men coming back from World War I, many of them who were injured or disabled in some way, psychologically or physically.
Well, let's go deeper into that. What were some of the biggest health challenges and social challenges that that World War I cohort of veterans was facing?
Yeah. A variety of very unique problems. To begin with, there was the influenza epidemic of 1918, and there were many men in the armed services who contracted this terrible influenza because they were all living in crowded conditions, and they had all sorts of sequelae or problems after the fact, depression, pulmonary or lung problems, weakness, and so on. There's also a terrible weapon called mustard gas, which the Germans used quite a bit on the Allied forces, and that really destroyed and scarred lung tissue and vision and other problems. So there were physical disabilities, bullets, of course. There were other infectious diseases that people could get in the trenches, so to speak, most famously trench foot, because you're sitting in wet boots and wet uniforms in this muddy water, and it could cause fungal infections of the feet and even amputations of the feet. So you had people with one leg or one arm as a result of their serving in the armed forces or worse, and not very good physical medicine and rehab type services because they weren't invented yet. And then most interesting, at least to me, is what was called combat fatigue and people who were psychologically damaged by being in the throes of war. We now know it as post-traumatic stress disorder. It's very real, it's very debilitating, and it's very serious, but we didn't have the knowledge about these problems at the time.
So you come home from being in the trenches in Belgium, and here you are kind of supposed to reintegrate, but you didn't have the kinds of things that we think about today as available services.
Yeah,
that
nobody really cared. They moved on. They had moved on. It was the Roaring Twenties. And nobody wanted to hear about what happened in Flanders Field. And also the people who stayed behind. This is where, by the way, the word slacker comes from. It's not a new word. It's for those men who did not go into World War I, into the armed services. They were called slackers. But if they stayed behind, they got a leg up on the occupational journey of jobs. And so these people came back, these men came back to find their jobs taken up by slackers. So that was something that was a sore point as well.
So where did the impetus begin to actually create something that was unified that could help them?
So on August 8th in 1921, when Warren Harding signed it into order that there would be a Veterans Bureau. It did not become the Veterans Administration until the Reagan administration, when it became an actual part of the president's cabinet. And the head of the VA is the Secretary of Veterans Administrations now. But it started the next day on August 9th, and a man named Charles Forbes, who was the head of the Bureau of War Risk Insurance, because a lot of the things that existed for veterans were really insurance policies, not health care per se, but pensions. And this man, Forbes, gathered together all these various cogs in the federal wheel, which is not such an easy task, this agency, that agency, and so on, and built out of it, cobbled out of it, what we now know today as the Veterans Administration. And that included building hospitals and clinics that were specifically designed for the care of vets and their health problems.
And it's interesting, as I read your account of the birth of the VA, to get this single unified government agency launched, the Veterans Bureau, it was truly a bipartisan effort.
It was. The vets were very good at complaining to their congressmen and to their senators. And there was a great deal more cooperation in the 20s. I mean, the good old days were never as good as people really like to think. But there was at least some cooperation, and people from across the aisle spoke to one another. And this was something both sides could get together, that we need to do something for those men, and now our men and women, who serve in uniform.
What worked well and what didn't work so well in those early days of the veterans' hospitals?
Well, what worked particularly well was the notion that you need specific hospitals that have physical medicine facilities, prosthetic facilities, and long-term psychiatric and psychological care for people who served in the military. The pension and insurance systems did not work all that well and had to be reinvented and reinvented across time. What didn't work well was the internecine battles between all these government agencies who were losing their power, losing their turf to be subsumed under this Veterans Bureau. And Charles Forbes, who was doing all this, was attacked viciously. Mm-hmm. And now, don't forget, the Warren Harding administration was not exactly known for how do I say it politely? Not taking bribes. That was not.
Let's just say there was a lot of corruption in the Harding era.
Yeah,
yes.
Very few people know exactly what Teapot Dome was, but it was a scam about bribes over an oil field, and there was a lot of graft. And Charles Forbes was accused of taking contracts that were to his benefit rather than the veterans. He actually was sentenced for over a year to Leavenworth. The original big house. But he maintained his innocence. And in fact, historians have demonstrated that he probably was not guilty at all. He probably did not do what he was accused of doing. But there was so much graft going on in the Harding administration that many members of his cabinet were accused of doing bad things.
Through the years, VA doctors, VA nurses have really pioneered the kind of treatments that we all take for granted, such as?
Well, you can begin with the treatment of trench foot. And you can begin with, you know, now we, a lot of us who have a bad knee or a bad hip or what have you, go to a physical medicine and rehab doctor. But that specialty developed out of war injuries. My great uncle Joe spent his career working as a rehab specialist at the Allen Park VA, and his patients were people who lost legs or arms or both or all. And we now benefit from all of that. And we are finding with post-traumatic stress disorder that the VA hospitals really pioneered in that field. It's a disease not so much of remembering, but an inability to forget. And these loops in your brain are developed that you get very panicky and upset and nervous and a lot of physical symptoms when you are confronted with anything remotely close to that experience. It's very real. It's very debilitating.
And isn't it interesting that these problems that you're talking about are exactly what returning veterans, say, from Afghanistan and Iraq have been dealing with, are dealing with.
Yep.
Not in the past.
Yes, and it's not. It doesn't just benefit. What we found from history is that the stuff that we're learning at the VA system for vets doesn't just benefit vets, that it has been expanded to the society at large. So I mentioned rehab medicine, but you could argue that there are an awful lot of people with post-traumatic stress disorder who never went to Afghanistan or Iraq but had their own tragic circumstances occur, and we are learning more and more about this very real entity because of their work, the VA work.
And here we are, 96 years later. What do you see as the questions that we should be asking about the VA?
Well, one question is, do vets need a separate health care system that is segregated from the general health care system? And that's a question of economics and of how do we fund health care in America, something that we still haven't quite.
We're wrestling with that. Yeah.
It changes almost daily. It's very hard to keep track of that. That's an economic question. A more a broader philosophical or social question is, how do we honor, how do we take care of those men and women who protected and defended our liberties and freedom? I think that's a very important task. I think these men and women have done a remarkable job that very few of us have done, and they deserve to be honored and cared for no matter what happens to them over there.
Good thoughts on this 96th birthday of the launch of the Veterans Administration. Dr. Howard Markell, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. It's primary election day for cities in Michigan. There have been scattered, unconfirmed reports of polls opening late, voters being turned away at others. Last November's election brought to light what is actually a series of sloppy elections across Michigan, according to a report in Bridge Magazine written by Joel Kurth. He was on Stateside yesterday. You can find that interview at michiganradio.org. Here to talk about some improvements this time, and hopefully more by November of 2018, is Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. So first, any major problems today?
I haven't heard of any major problems. The new machines in 11 out of 52 counties that are having elections today, the machines are working well and things are pretty smooth. So we're really glad to hear that.
I'm glad that you brought up new voting machines. Now, this is being used for the first time in some municipalities. Why are they better?
Well, they're better in so many ways. I mean, in the last 10 years, technology has soared when it comes to tabulators or voting machines. They're more flexible. For the people that work there, they're much more compact, easier to transport, easier to set up. They don't jam or tempt like the old ones. The ballot programming is much easier. And the programming for the accessible device for people, those that have disabilities, is seamless and automatically connects to the tabulator programming. Security enhancements are significant, which we need to have because technology in 10 years is kind of old hat, right?
Right. And that security issue brings up whether this system is any more vulnerable to cyber attacks. One of the things that made Michigan's strong is that's not really a possibility. What about with these new machines?
Yes, we got very secure machines for Michigan again. We have paper backups, which I think is so important. Some places in the country are using DREs, direct recording electronics. They don't have any way to check after the election, and I just think that's wrong. And I did write a letter in February to Vice President Pence with a five-point plan if that was important. That was one of the things. So we have several levels of role-based security. It's different capabilities that is ready for the clerk, the precinct supervisor, the precinct worker. We have 30,000 of them, and if a jam occurs, which is unlikely now, but a clear message to the voters and workers will be shown as to whether the ballot was counted so that they can redo it if they need to. And they have digital technology, which also provides for e-copy of the ballot along with that paper copy, I think is so important. And they're more user-friendly. The layout's slightly different. Some people will find a box to fill in, some the oval, and they'll be closer together. You know, when they used to read across the page, sometimes they would get one off. That's been fixed. And they'll see a more descriptive message on the screen indicating if there's any issues with their ballots and the specific problem so that it can be fixed. I think that's important. And our main priority is to ensure elections are never compromised. And for that reason, another one of my five-point plans for the country is our machines are not connected to the internet. And again, the paper ballots ensure we can always do a recount.
The feds ponied up $30 million. The legislature came up with another $10 million for the machines. Is that enough to replace voting machines all over the state by next year?
Yeah, actually, the Help America Vote Act, we have had the money for over 10 years, and we saved it. Some states spent that grant. We saved it so that we could assist our cities and townships, knowing that it's a heavy cost. The way we bid it out, we got real sharp pencils. We think the best prices in the nation for these machines. And yes, it covers all the fees, all the maintenance fees for the first 5 years, and the locals will have time to save up. They will be responsible for the second 5 years. So they'll only need to finance the maintenance costs after the first 5 years.
That Bridge Magazine article I mentioned earlier noted that some people think there needs to be wholesale reform in how Michigan conducts its elections because it grants local communities far more oversight of elections than most any other state. How much additional complexity does that cause?
Well, we are local home rule, and your local clerk's going to be much more accountable to you than somebody in, say, a county clerk, 83 clerks. We have 1,520 local clerks. And actually, the Pew Center named our clerks some of the best clerks in the nation. They do a really good job. It is more difficult for us. We do give the information to those clerks to train their precinct workers, and that's 30,000 people that often work one or two times a year. You're not going to have people that work the elections more than that, no matter what you do. So we also have started an interactive virtual university. We've done 2 to 5 minute YouTube videos on the issues so people don't really have to go through the manuals. They can just look it up and They can watch that to see what to do. And I think you'll find these new machines, because they don't jam like the old ones, that you're not going to have the problems that you had in the last election with these new machines, because what was happening is they would get tented up and jammed, and then they'd empty them out. And at the end of the night, some of the precinct workers did not take them out of the machine. They were tired. So we have checklists for all of them to make sure the receiving boards get what they're supposed to. So they're put in a secured, sealed bin so they can be recounted. And I think all these things that we've done are really going to show in the next election, and this one too. But this one, unfortunately, there's a very light turnout is what I've been reading.
So you don't think it's a problem of poll workers not being trained properly? It's more of equipment failure and such?
No, it was the fact when they emptied out the machines, every vote counted, but they left a lot in the bins at night.
So it couldn't be audited correctly, right?
Right. That was the major problem in the state of Michigan. And so, you know, we advise that local clerks conduct. We've really, really pushed that the receiving boards use the checklist to make sure every ballot's been taken out of those boxes. They were all counted, but the problem is if you have some in one of the canisters that's sealed and some in the tabulator, the ones in the tabulator didn't get into that bag or box, and so by state law they cannot be recounted. So I think we've taken care of that, and it's one of those things, elections 5 years from now, there may be something else that we need to do or more security. It's a continuous process.
That is Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. Thanks very much for taking the time today.
Thank you, and if you haven't registered to vote, please do that so you can vote in the next election and make sure you take time to exercise your privilege and, I think, your obligation.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has released a long-anticipated study on ways to prevent Asian carp from spreading from the Mississippi River system to the Great Lakes through a man-made canal at Chicago. Joining me to talk about the carp and the plan is Tammy Newcomb. She's a senior water policy advisor for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Before we start talking about this plan, let's back up and talk about why this is a problem. There are four species of these Asian carp: silver carp, bighead carp, grass carp, and the black carp. A lot of us have seen the videos of carp jumping out of the water as a motorboat goes down the river. So which of these carp does that?
It can be very confusing, but I just tell everybody to take a deep breath. We always talk about different species of trout all the time, and so carp are not unlike that. There's four different species of Asian carp that are here stateside. One of them we'll talk about first is called the grass carp, and the grass carp eats vegetation, and they pose a lot of threat to wetlands and emergent vegetation. They've been prohibited in Michigan since the 60s. In 2012, USGS found some reproducing. The ones that are around are supposed to be sterile from the other locations, but the USGS, the Geological Survey, found some reproducing grass carp in the Sandusky River in Ohio. And so immediately Ohio and Michigan started talking, and we've been working on that problem and developing a plan to address those grass carp. But again, grass carp have been around for more than 30 years in the Great Lakes, and they have not exhibited the explosive types of invasive properties that some of these other carp have. So that's grass carp. We'll put that off to the side. The other three species are the black carp, the bighead carp, and the silver carp. Black carp are different from the bighead and silver and grass carp in that they eat snails and mussels. And so, as you can imagine, their diet is unlimited here in the Great Lakes, but that's not a good thing because when they eat them, they would convert them to things that are not helpful to our Great Lakes. But black carp right now are about 150 miles from the Great Lakes, and they're yet another one that we have watched come up the Mississippi River.
Now, that one was brought in by catfish farmers, is that right?
So yes, that was brought in for aquaculture to eat snails in their aquaculture ponds, and they, once again with flooding, got introduced into the Mississippi River from flooding events where farmers' ponds got overtopped and then these fish went out into the Mississippi.
Okay, now we're at silver and bighead.
Now we're down to silver and bighead, and those are the two of the day. Those are the two that we talk about as being an imminent threat to the Great Lakes. And the first thing that I want to say is that there have been people who have said, oh, they won't do anything in the Great Lakes because it's too cold. Well, that absolutely is not true. Oh, they won't populate the Great Lakes because they're lakes. Well, guess what? These guys have been motoring through up the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio,
rivers with no abandon, and they're a lake species. So they've been doing just fine in rivers. Imagine what they will do when they get into the preferred environment of lakes.
So these are not riverine fish. They don't prefer rivers.
They prefer to spend their days in lowland backwaters without a lot of current. They do need rivers to spawn, and that will keep their eggs suspended. But they actually prefer environments without river currents in them. And that's why when Illinois will talk about them, or some of the other researchers will talk about them, they'll say they're in these backwater areas in abundance, or they're in these off-channel areas. But the reality is, in the rivers, their abundances become so high that you just see them everywhere.
Is this damage that we're concerned about to the Great Lakes or to the rivers that flow into the Great Lakes?
Well, exactly. So these fish are going to be where these phytoplankton and then zooplankton, which are the small animals in the water column.
Sure, it's the food base for all the fish.
It's the food base for everything. We can think about it like grass for sheep, right? It's the lawn that's out there that the fish can take advantage of. In the case of the Great Lakes, a lot of our small fish really rely on that early food base for their early life histories to survive. And the other thing that we've learned from another invader called the alewife is that the fish that feed in the water column like that really do a number on our larval fish. So they can eat the larval fish, prey on the larval fish, before we ever get a chance to even record them. And we've seen the effect of alewife in, like, Saginaw Bay on walleye and perch. And after alewife were gone, we fully saw all of a sudden all of this natural reproduction occurring. And it's because those fish were not preying, the alewife were not preying on the walleye and perch. So back to bighead and silver carp, that's exactly what we're worried about with bighead and silver carp. There may not be a ton of them out in the open waters of the Great Lakes, but our nearshore areas and our places like the Drowned River mouth in Muskegon, Saginaw Bay, any of those nearshore areas that have the energy content that these fish need, that phytoplankton and those zooplankton, that's where they'll be. They'll also be in our rivers. They will also be in our inland lakes. And so that is why we are so afraid of these fish getting in. People say, well, we can just have predators eat them, right? Well, the problem with that is these fish can grow so fast that within a very short time frame, less than a year, they're too big for most of our predators to even eat.
So let's talk about what's been done to stop these fish from getting into the Great Lakes. Now, there was an electric barrier built in this man-made channel originally to prevent the invasive round goby, which had invaded the Great Lakes, from spreading to the Mississippi River system. That didn't work, so it was rebranded as a carp barrier working in the opposite direction. Another improved electric barrier was built to stop carp from swimming into the Great Lakes. Why is that not enough?
So the electric barrier system, it's actually a system of three electric barriers that was the pilot barrier, and then there was a 2A and 2B barriers. And the idea there is that one barrier can be turned off and maintained while the other is still left on. The first barrier, the pilot barrier, is now also being replaced. But the issue with those electric barriers, even now, is still that when a barge goes through, it sort of sucks all the electricity out of the water. If you think about the electrical current through the water as a fence, if you will, it changes and puts holes in that fence, which allows for there to be what we call a shadow effect from the barge moving through. So there's actually places where the fish can get through under that system. And then also the other issue is that we know fish can get entrained in between the spaces between the barges. So if you think of the prow front of a boat hooking up to a flat end back of another barge, there's a space in there, the void spaces they're called, that small fish have been shown to be able to be entrained or in there and move through without being affected by that electric barrier.
So why can't we just shut down this man-made channel linking the Mississippi River system to Lake Michigan?
So that's a very good question, and one that many still question today. Physical separation is a place that would allow us the greatest certainty to protect the Great Lakes. But there is a number of businesses and then the barge operators, not our ship-going vessels, but barge operators that operate within the Chicago area waterway that haul aggregate, they haul chemicals, they haul grains. And so there's still a commercial market for those commodities to be transversed through this system.
Yeah, is any of that cargo so valuable that it's worth risking all the fishing in the Great Lakes?
Well, I think it depends on which side of the boundary you're sitting on.
And whether you own a barge company or not, I suppose. So let's talk about this new study by the Army Corps of Engineers. It suggests, what does it suggest we should do to block the Asian carp from the Great Lakes?
The Brandon Road study that just came out shows a tentatively selected plan where at this Brandon Road lock and dam, there's a pinch point in the river. And it's a great place because the approach channel to the lock is very long and narrow. And then the water, the remaining water, just flows over High Head Dam. And so at this location, no matter what solution is implemented there, it's not going to flood downtown Chicago because the water, again, can just pass over the dam. But nothing can get upstream past there. So in this dam and then the lock chamber itself, this approach to the lock gives us an opportunity to really reduce the risk because we're simply reducing the amount of area that you have to put these control measures in. And so this study that we finally get to talk about is talking about an electrical design. I think there's some ways that we can think about it to improve the electrical design that's currently out there, as well as things like complex sound, which we know can deter fish, and then there's some water jet features to it as well to try and flush fish out of those entrained areas.
So where is this lock and dam in relation to the series of electric barriers already in place? And keep in mind, when you say upstream, downstream, water flows out of Lake Michigan down this channel and into the Illinois River eventually, right?
Right. So if you're coming into the Chicago River out of Lake Michigan, you're going to go 37 miles downstream before you encounter the first set of electric barriers. You'll travel a little bit further, about 4 to 6 miles, and you'll encounter the Lockport Lock and Dam. And then you're going to go another 4 to 6 miles, and you're going to get to the Brandon Road Lock and Dam. So the Brandon Road Lock and Dam structure is about 10 to 12, depending on how you measure it, miles downstream from the current electric barrier system. When I look at it, when we look at it from a risk reduction perspective, anything that we can do, and it's why Michigan has been a proponent of doing something at Brandon Road, anything that we can do there to reduce the risk first and foremost gives us an opportunity between Brandon Road Lock and Dam and that current electric barrier system to fix any mistakes, you know, to take care of any fish that may get through the first barrier, if you will.
So what's the Michigan Department of Natural Resources response to this plan?
So right now, we are very pleased to see the plan released. It gives us a start to the dialogue about how to protect the Great Lakes. So our response is we're eager to talk about the conversation, about the plans that are out there, to talk about how we proceed into the next steps beyond this point.
Final question. Environmental groups are urging quick action to start construction on these barriers. What's the timeline for approving this study and getting something done?
Right now it is a dialogue, and I believe we have 45 days to provide comments. So the Army Corps will take in that comment, and then it will be up to the Army Corps of Engineers to provide any further tweaks to the plan as it is and then present the plan forward through their process. And then after that, it's a congressional action. So I can't put a direct timeline on it for you, but there's a process out there, and it's very important that people make their opinions known as it pertains to protecting the Great Lakes.
So besides public comment, will the state have input during this period as well?
Yes, we will be making active input with the Army Corps of Engineers. And we have worked closely with the Corps of Engineers. I will say that I'm very pleased in this part of the Glimmerus report that it does better reflect some of the things that are so sacred to us in the Great Lakes, reflecting that boating industry, reflecting the fishery, some of the things that the first Glimmerus report several years ago did not contain. I do think that it gives protecting the Great Lakes more of a narrative in this report.
Okay. That's Tammy Newcomb. She's Senior Water Policy Advisor for the Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about a new study to block the Asian carp from invading the Great Lakes. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Claire Bryan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.